Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, my friends. I'm Eric Olson, and it's time once again for America's Most Haunted Radio, bringing together the finest minds and personalities from across the paranormal spectrum. On this special edition of AMH Radio, we talk with the world-famous haunted housewives, including my America's Most Haunted co-author, Teresa Argy, and the ghost lady, Kathy Weber. Welcome, ladies.
Thanks, Eric.
What's with all the chuckling?
I'm a guest on my own show. It's awesome.
And I'm world famous.
I thought it was time. Don't you?
Yes.
Absolutely. So, let's go back to the beginning. I think a lot of people have kind of heard some version of the story of how you guys met over at, I believe, Willoughby Cole. But I don't want to put words in your mouth. You guys tell us how you met.
Oh, that's easy. I stalked Kathy until the restraining order finally wore out and she agreed to work with me.
Pretty much.
Kind of, yeah. Kathy actually was doing some work with some women that I was on a team with, one of my previous ghost hunting teams, and they had done a fundraiser. And I thought that was really interesting and an interesting way to kind of combine the paranormal with doing good for the community. So I unfortunately couldn't make that fundraiser, but they said, oh, you should meet Kathy. She's really cool. She's a historian. And I liked that whole history aspect of it. So I literally found out where Kathy worked and went to her shop and just kind of started hanging out there and went on the Willoughby Ghost Walk, which was her business at the time, and was just fascinated by the combination of the hauntings and the history. And after that, I had a crazy experience on my first ghost walk. And then I just hounded her until she agreed to start doing actual investigations with me. That's pretty much it, right, Kath?
Well, I always say that her friends sicked her on me. And so they had said, you know, they couldn't help me with something, but they said, we have someone perfect who would love to help you. Her name's Teresa Argy, and you should hook up with her. So I'm like, this stranger comes on the ghost walk one night, and she's chit-chatting away, and we make it down to Willoughby Call. And my most memorable moment of meeting Teresa was when we were at Willoughby Call, and she threw up on my shoes. Because she seemed to say that, you know, being in the presence of great spiritual activity makes her feel a little ill at times. And all we were doing was standing towards the front door, and she started to become violently ill and kept saying, I don't know what's wrong with me. I don't know what's wrong with me. I think I'm going to throw up. So that's my most memorable moment of meeting Teresa Argy.
I didn't make a very good first impression.
Mm-mm. And then I told her, I was very interested in the history and the mystery and the storytelling and the fundraising, but not necessarily the paranormal investigative aspects. Even though I had been on several paranormal investigations, I didn't feel that was my calling, if you will. But Teresa insisted that I was missing the point, and I had to go on several paranormal investigations to get a feeling for it. And after she mentored me through my first one, I was basically hooked, and that was the end of that story. I've been investigating with her ever since.
So for being such bosom buddies, you guys are well nigh inseparable. I mean, it really hasn't been that long, right? What year was it when you started working together?
About 5 years.
2009? Yeah, 2009.
About 5 years ago.
So, Kathy, how did you get into the whole ghost walk thing in the first place?
Well, I love history. It's a passion of mine, and I love historical research. So I'm kind of one of those history nerds. So when we travel around the country or even out of the country, I'm very much into the tours and the histories and the museums and the old houses. And through the years, as my husband and I, he loves to travel, so we do it a lot. And we always used to take a ghost walk or a mystery tour or something that would involve history and mystery in the cities that we would visit. And one year we were sitting around and I said to him, wouldn't it be great if we had like a ghost walk here in Willoughby? And he said, well, why don't you run with that? And next thing you knew, I started to work on researching for the Willoughby Ghost Walk, and I got everything together. And the first year I pulled it out, I just couldn't believe it was really happening. And it's been 7 years now. We're going to be entering our 8th season next year, and it has been, I must admit, fairly successful, and people, doggone it, they seem to like it. So that's how I got into the Ghost Walk.
How has it evolved over time?
It has evolved greatly into almost an umbrella for many other things. The first years, you know, I was just doing the tour, and I was talking to people about ghosts and talking about history. And next thing you know, I got a phone call from some stranger I don't know. And he says, hi, you know, I'm calling to see if you'd like to write a book. And I'm like, hello? And he said, would you like to write a book? You know, I'm calling from this publishing company. And then I hung up on him because I thought it was a crank call. So he called me back, and I said, who are you? And he said, well, I would like you to write a book for the History Press. And I said, well, I don't know anything about writing books. Why would you think I could write a book? And he said, who wrote the script for your Ghost Walk? Because we've gotten several phone calls that it's a really great thing to go on and has the right kind of material and information that we like in our books. And next thing you knew, I got on to writing a book called Haunted Willoughby, and that was in 2010. And then it branched out into working with the Lake County History Center and other historical centers, helping them with their fundraising, which involves a lot of history and a lot of ghosts. So it's just branched out from there. It's been a pretty wild ride.
So as Teresa has mentioned several times, and it comes up regularly, you guys are really, really busy doing these charitable events, the fundraising mm-hmm. events. Seems like mostly they're bunched down into November. How did all of that come about, and what places are you now supporting in that manner?
You want to field that one, Teresa? Or you want
no, go ahead. This is you started this. Take this is your baby, man. Kathy does 99% of the work for our fundraisers, so she absolutely is the queen mother, and you take your credit where it's due, lady.
Well, I will tell you, I started to work with the Lake County History Center because of the research for my book that I wanted, and for the Willoughby Ghost Walk. I wanted to be accurate. I wanted to have as much information as possible that was historical. And then they started to tell me about how they were lacking in funds and support in the community and how hard it was for them to take care of their building, which is a very large building, the former Lake County Poorhouse out in Painesville. And I said, well, you should do a fundraiser of some sort involving, you know, all the ghostly spirits out here. And they said, well, how would we do that? And I said, basically, when you do a paranormal investigation, you unlock the doors and turn off the lights and walk away. And you let the investigators in. I said, well, so that would be your responsibility. And they said, really? And I said, we're very interested. And the very first year we did it, we made $3,000 in one night just allowing ghost hunters into experience the spirits of the Lake County History Center. Now we have Lake County History Center. We have a foundation in Richmond Heights called the Greenwood Farms Foundation, trying to save a historical property out there. We've worked with the Painesville Railroad Depot, which is the Western Reserve Railroad Association. They are always looking for funds to try to continue their efforts to save that depot. We've worked with, so many places that need our help. And we're willing.
The Indian Museum?
Indian Museum,
yeah.
And
the Indian Museum. The Indian
and
Museum
even,
Lake County.
And even the the Welcome Center in Willoughby needed some help raising funds to afford a new center, which they now have. And we did a fundraiser at Willoughby Cole. We did more than one for them. So we've done a lot of fundraising for different organizations to try to help out when we can.
And we branched out a little bit too,
because
this
have.
Year we were asked to do a fundraiser at Hillview Manor for the Columbiana County Humane Society with Parapaws. And that was awesome. I mean, mm-hmm. it was an awesome event, and Scott, who's actually mentioned in our book, he was the organizer for that, and we were very happy to do that because that's something different. That's not really a historical thing per se, but it was still mm-hmm. a fundraiser and still a very good cause, and we were happy to do it. Unfortunately, the problem with that, which we found out of these other fundraisers that other people run, they get real greedy, and the actual charity does not get that much of the funds that are raised. So we would like to work with Scott for one of his animal protective associations and do one maybe at a different place, because no offense against the people that we worked with at Hillview, because they were great, but the management and the owner of Hillview took about 90% of those
right.
profits, and we didn't know that. And, you know, we gave up a night of the Ghost Walk, so that's all of Kathy's funds for the Ghost Walk. So no income for her that night. No income for me as a guide that night.
Right.
We had to travel to Pennsylvania. And we don't mind doing it. But then when we found out that they took almost 90% of the funds, that just gets our goat up. I mean, we do this for nothing. Kathy loses money on these fundraisers because we don't even take our cost out. And I don't know anybody who does that. And that's probably something we should rethink or we're going to go broke. But she doesn't even take her costs out of this stuff. So, but we're passionate about it. I mean, that's a big deal for us. That what I think sets us apart from these thrill-seeking ghost hunters, which is fine. I mean, people love to do this stuff for different reasons, and I have no problem with that. I think it's great that they're involved at all. But, you know, I mean, we do it for more than just the thrill of the hunt and something to do on the weekends. We're away from our family, and it's got to be worth our while. If not financially, which it isn't, it has to mean something to us personally.
And I feel paranormal investigators have to really think about where their money is going when they go to these places. Like, I don't want to blow the horn on several, but there are some in our area. I can think of two off the top of my head that they take your money and you can come in and ghost hunt, fine. But what kind of updates have you seen to that historic property? The preservation of the history of the property is not a part of the goal of the people taking your ghost hunting money. And I can think of two right now that are like, they take that money and they line their pockets and their building is falling down in the meantime. It's almost unsafe to ghost hunt at some places that are taking money. So when we do our fundraisers, we are truly giving all of that money over to the organization that we're raising funds for so that they can try to preserve their historic site.
Wow. Well, and I think all of that is becoming well known. I think through just the various outlets and that we've kind of all gained over the fairly recent past, what with the book coming out, and I've been hearing about the Haunted Housewives and about these events, especially the November fundraisers, from a variety of sources. So I think that's a really good sign. They're being mentioned. People are really starting to be aware of them and of you guys in association with that. Hey, I want to shift gears because while Teresa and I are the authors of America's Most Haunted, I mean, Kathy, you're in it as a functioning persona far more often. You're in the action far more than I am. So I wanted to talk about those various locations that you guys investigated together, either, you know, prior to us working on the book, but also you did a couple. I know at least the LEMP, you know, specifically for the book. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on each of those locations in kind of whatever order you want. I suppose maybe start with the Ohio State Reformatory simply because it's our number one and it's certainly the big bomber in the state.
The Ohio State Reformatory was a great place, and obviously we knew about it. I think anybody who's involved with the paranormal who lives in our area is familiar with the Reformatory. And that was one of the first places that Kathy and I actually investigated with we had a big group with us that night, though. It was one of the bigger things that we did together. It wasn't my first time there or anything, but it was the first time I was there with Kathy, was an event that we did with Michelle Bellanger. And John Kachuba was there that night, I believe, right? And Trina, the investigators of the past, they help us out with the Lake County History Center fundraiser. And Jackie Williams, and these people are all, I think, at least some of them are mentioned in the book. But that was a big event. And that night, again, every time we've been there, I think we've had things happen. But this particular night, Kathy and I had a very profound experience.
Yes, we did.
I mean, it was towards the end of the night, and we find this to be true with ghost hunters, and I think anybody who does an investigation will agree with us, to happen when you're not expecting it, when you're done for the night, when you're packing up, or when you're setting up, not when you're ready for it, not when you have your equipment out, but when you're least expect it. And this particular incident happened when we were actually done for the night. I think all our guests had gone except for Trina and a couple of her friends, and me and Kathy, and I think then a couple of the volunteers that were still there. And we were going back to out of the cell block and into the superintendent's quarters to go back to the break room. And this break room is not there anymore. It was this extra annex building that they had there for a few years. It's no longer there. But we were heading back that way. And as we entered, and we know the door, as we entered the door to go into the superintendent's house, we heard this woman's cry. And it was loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at Kathy, and she looked at me, and we're like, what the heck was that? Because there wasn't anybody else in the superintendent's house at all.
It was the weirdest thing, because it was loud and clear that it was a person moaning out in distress. And we just, like she said, it seemed like time froze. We just stood there looking at each other like, can this be real? And I think I waited for like somebody to walk out of the shadows.
Right.
It was so human-like. And then we did, you know, we were like, of course, all our equipment was put away, but we said we got to go up. You know, we went looking all around to see where this sound could have come from. And, of course, no one was in that area. And it seemed to fill the hall where we were. It was like a loud moaning sustained and definitely female in nature. So,
we found Trina. Amazing. When we found Trina, we asked if that was them that made that sound. And they looked at us like, no, we thought it was you guys. We're mm-hmm. like, no. So they heard it. They were in the west cell block. Or the east cell block. I don't remember which one. They were in the cell block,
east.
And they could hear it from where they were, and they were nowhere near us. We couldn't hear them, and with what they were doing. So it wasn't any sort of normal sound. But this sound was so loud, we heard it in the superintendent's house, and they heard it in one of the cell blocks. And we were the only people there. There were no female volunteers there.
Mm-mm.
At the time either. I think it was maybe Scott and Chris and a couple other of the OSR volunteers. But that was amazing. And the reason that it's that particular sound in that area means something is because of the story of Helen Glacky. Mm-hmm. And she was one of the superintendents. Her husband, Arthur Glacky, was a superintendent at the reformatory. And she actually died due to an accident that happened in that part of the prison. And so we assumed, and maybe it's an assumption, but we assumed that it was Helen Glacky that was crying out. And
mm-hmm.
that story we talk about in the book, and I still to this day believe that that was her, and that
I
she
do
was
too.
Trying to tell us something. Absolutely.
And it was strange because we both came to that conclusion almost instantaneously that it seemed like it could be Helen crying out, and her story is a sad one because she died of a gunshot wound that was inflicted right there in her bedroom.
Of all the different sounds that you would expect to capture or to hear on a ghost hunt at a haunted abandoned prison, a female voice is not one you would expect.
Mm-mm.
So the story of Helen, and you know, and there's lots of controversy around her death, and different people have different views of how she died. The story goes that she was getting ready for church and she reached into her closet to get a hat box or jewelry, something off a shelf, and the box had a loaded gun in it, and the box fell, and when the box fell, the gun fell, and it went off, and it shot her in the chest. And Eric, you know this as well as I do, that story is very hard to believe, but it was ruled an accident. And Eric, and you know, we did the research on this. We can't disprove that it was an accident. We can't prove that it wasn't an accident either, but it seems a very strange story. So either way, what Kathy and I conclude, and I think this is in the book too, whether it was an accident or whether it was intentionally shot, but at the very least it was negligence. Why there was a loaded gun in her closet and not Arthur's closet, and why, if they knew the gun was faulty, it was there at all, why was it where prisoners could actually get to there? Because there were trustees that had access to this part of Helen's room. So at the very least, it was negligence. Was it intentional murder? Was it an accident? We don't know. But I think, and I think Kathy believes this,
mm-hmm.
it was definitely Helen wants the truth to come out. Whatever that truth is, I believe that that's why her spirit is still there. She wants people to know the truth. Is her husband innocent? Is he guilty? Was it an accident? Was it murder? Was it negligence? What happened? And I think that's why her spirit is still there.
You and know, it seems like she leads us sometimes when we are there.
Yeah.
It seems to me, when anytime I think about the story, and certainly when we were actually researching it and writing it up, even if it is exactly the way that it was portrayed officially, and you know there are motivations why people would want to keep it as quiet and as contained as possible. Certainly, if anyone close to her had been involved, that would be very strong motivation. And there were some irregularities about reporting and that kind of thing. But nonetheless, even if it did happen the way the official story, it is such a bizarrely unlikely sequence of events that she could have been just as outraged by that as if she had been murdered. It's like, oh my God, how unfair is this? To be killed in this freakish manner. This is just bizarre. So I think she could be just as outraged and perhaps, you know, hanging around and with information to convey either way, like you said. So you guys had something else. It's kind of, boy, in all the interviews that we've done for the book, and we certainly ended up doing quite a few in the 5 or 6 week blitz, which of course we appreciate and had a lot of fun doing, and I think went a long way to getting the word out. But what people always seem to come back to over and over and over again is the tale of Mike Evans, and that began at the reformatory.
Oh my God.
Yes,
Mike.
It did.
Well, and Mike, actually, I think the first time we met Mike was on that first investigation. Jackie Williams is a very good friend of ours, and she is a sensitive. She's a psychic medium. And I was doing my ghost hunter thing, and I think John Kachuba was in one of the cells down in solitary, and he wasn't getting much action. And I think Jackie told him, well, you know, they don't want you in there. You're a guy. So I went into the cell, and she told me, go in that cell. She's like, made a dog sound like a hound, like a bloodhound, like woo-woo-woo, signaling that she thought there was something going on in this particular cell. And I went in there, and I started doing an EVP session, and she's laughing. And I'm like, what's so funny? And she's like, well, you're pissing this guy off. And I'm like, why? She said, well, you're asking him questions, and he's answering you, but you're not hearing him. I said, well, tell him I can't hear him. And she said, well, he's done with you. He wants you out of his cell. And she described him as being, you know, maybe in his late 20s, kind of tall, skinny, wearing like a shirt, kind of dirty hair, kind of longish. She just described this guy. He kind of had a 70s vibe to him when she described him to me. Well, we went back later, a couple years later or a year later, we went back doing another investigation with some other friends of ours. And we were trying to get communication with the same spirit, because this spirit on that night, it was obvious he did not like me from the get-go. And we were down at solitary again, and we were in the same area of the cells. And we asked, you know, what is your name? Or do you remember us? Questions like that, the usual thing. And we got the response when we asked for a name of Mike Evans. Mm-hmm. And it even gave us a prison number. At least we got part of a prison number. We got the first few digits of the prison number. And we found out later that that kind of corresponds with the years that the prisoners would have been there. And so this Mike Evans, and from what we got through the EVP session, was that this was the same spirit that we had encountered before that didn't like me in his cell. And he still wasn't happy with me, but he sure did take a liking to Kathy.
It was the mother thing, I think. I don't know, for some reason when we go to a male prison, I don't think a lot about the male prisoners and all the horrible things they've done. I think about their mothers, and I usually talk about their mothers, and, you know, I always let them know I'm a mom, and, you know, my son has disappointed me in my life, and his, you know, his life and my life, we both had disappointments, but it's like not as bad as going to prison. And I talk out loud to them about it on an intimate level, and I think that that's why I get responses sometimes that are involving their moms, and we get responses back. We've heard a man crying mother on an EVP. So I don't know if Mike was that appealed to Mike or what appealed to Mike, but he decided to jump on, and he was on board for a few years.
Well, the problem is that after we left the prison that night, this Mike Evans, or a spirit named Mike with the same voice that we would hear on the first EVPs that we caught, the same voice, the same name, started coming up on other investigations in other locations. And I found that very disturbing. And it got to the point where I believe this spirit was following Kathy. And several times we went back to the Ohio State Reformatory. We did several more investigations. We've been there a bazillion times. And he's always there, and he's always talking. And this is a spirit that cusses me out and calls me names and threatens to kill me, and I'm an F&B and blah, blah, blah. And I hear it all the time. But when it comes to Kathy, it seems like he has a different outlook and a different kind of respect for her. But we did get some interesting verification. When I worked with the archivist, Shannon Lusk, when she was the archivist there at the reformatory, and I was going through prison records and pictures and mugshots and looking for Mike Evans, for some sort of verification that there was a Mike Evans there during the 70s. And unfortunately, we couldn't get anything. But when Kathy and I were out in L.A., we were filming an episode of My Ghost Story, and we were talking about the Ohio State Reformatory. And we had been there, we had gone back, and we had shot some B-roll with the producers. And so we were in L.A. Talking about the Ohio State Reformatory. And then I get a text message from one of the volunteers that say they found something interesting down in solitary. And here in one of the cells in solitary, this prison has been closed since 1990. So every so often, layers of paint just keep peeling off the walls due to condensation and moisture and just general deterioration. And they say that every time a layer of paint is peeled off, it's like peeling back, so many years, like 3, 4, 5 years, how many years it was between paintings. So like an onion, it peels off these layers. And down in one of the solitary cells, they found graffiti on the roof, the roof of the cell that said Evans, with the same prison number that we had got in the EVP.
Mm-hmm.
So I took that as verification.
It's pretty amazing. That, and we have a picture of it, too. In fact, we thought it was going to be in the book, but we won't get into that. There turned out to be many fewer pictures than we anticipated. But, oh, well, life goes on. All right, hey, let's take a real quick break, and we'll be right back on America's Most Haunted Radio. America's Most Haunted, The Secrets of Famous Paranormal Places, is now an epic book from Berkeley Penguin. History, legends, investigations, interviews, and profiles of America's 10 most haunted hotspots by Eric Olson and haunted housewife Teresa Argee. Be sure to join us on Twitter and Facebook at AM Haunted, Pinterest at America's Most Haunted, and our website, americas-most-haunted.com. And here every week on America's Most Haunted Radio with all the top names in the paranormal field. And we're back with the Haunted Housewives, Teresa Argee, whose name might sound familiar, and Kathy Weber, whose name also probably sounds quite familiar. Teresa is my co-author on the America's Most Haunted book, and Kathy is, of course, Teresa's partner in The Haunted Housewives and has many, many adventures that are detailed in the book. So let's talk about another one of the locations that you guys have investigated together. How about Waverly Hills? That was how I came in touch with you in the first place, watching that episode of Paranormal Challenge.
We love Waverly Hills.
Yes, we do.
Waverly was on our bucket list, and when we got the call that they were going to do this TV show, and we were asked to, and they didn't give us any information. We got called by a casting director, and he said, he'd like to interview us for this show on the Travel Channel with Zach Bagans, and they wouldn't tell us what it was, but they said it was a competition, paranormal competition show. And so Kathy and I were very skeptical going in. And we're like, how do you do this? How do you have a competition? And, you know, we didn't really know much about it, but they did not tell us where we were going. They called us the 1 week and they said, okay, we're going to film next weekend and we'll tell you where you're going to go the night before. But we couldn't do it because, I don't know, you were gone that weekend.
I was on vacation. Yeah,
you were on vacation. So then we held it off another week and they said, okay, you're going to go next weekend, but we're not going to tell you where we're going. So then we had to explain to them that we are haunted housewives and we have families and kids and we can't leave without telling our families where we're going. And they said, well, head south. You're heading towards Kentucky. And we immediately knew it was Waverly Hills.
And it was great because we originally found out we were supposed to have OSR, Ohio State Reformatory. And so we're kind of glad we passed on that because we have investigated so many times there. But getting Waverly Hills, one of our bucket list sites, was an amazing opportunity for us. And the show was an amazing opportunity as well. And it was the experience was very rewarding and very challenging at the same time. There were many challenges we faced during that competition show. Trust me, many.
Well, give us a few.
Well, okay, my favorite one that always comes to mind is the day they decided that on these night investigations we were not allowed to use any flashlights, which, you know, it's pretty important when you are doing any type of an investigation in the pitch dark that you do have some sort of illumination so you don't kill yourself. Well, they had us going up and down stairs and different things with absolutely no light. So it was an interesting challenge to face. There were also challenges with equipment. Part of the challenge, which you probably saw on the show, was they didn't even tell you what kind of equipment you were going to use until the last minute as you were walking out towards your investigation site. So that was another challenge that was a surprise to us. You had to grab this equipment and run with it, even though you might not have ever even used it before. So what were some other challenges we had, Teresa?
Well, I just remember trying to make my way up to the fifth floor in the dark with the banana cam on my body, and I couldn't see where I was going, and I ended up got lost in the dark. Thank God they didn't put that on TV. Mm-hmm. I ended up in the wrong hallway on the fourth floor trying to find the stairwell to the fifth floor. But eventually we did. I also wore the solo cam, they called it. I called it the banana cam or the snot cam because it faced right up your nose. But when I did my solo investigation in the body chute or the death tunnel that people call it, that was interesting because when we were doing the show, we were followed by one cameraman and one sound man, and then there was a PA that was a production assistant that was just kind of around in case something happened. He was not right there with us, but he was nearby. But when you did these solo investigations, you were completely alone. They had the entire facility rigged with cameras, mobile cameras, and they were watching from a different area of the property. So they could see what you were doing, but you couldn't see. There was nobody else around. So there was no cameraman. There was no sound guy, no production assistant. I was completely alone. And I was in that death tunnel, again, with no flashlight, looking through the viewfinder on my video camera just to make it down. And there are steps and there's rebarb that sticks up. If you've ever been in the death tunnel there, it's dangerous. It's crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember I said, I'm going to go all the way down. And I was just trying to make it all the way down to the end of the tunnel, which is about 500 feet. And I was going to come up. As I was going down, and I had to count my steps because I didn't want to trip. And I remembered from the walkthrough how many steps there were. And I would take four steps. I'd be like, one, two, three, four, step. One, two, three, four, step. And as I'm stepping, and I'd stop at four, and then I'd hear the footsteps behind me. And it started freaking me out. And then I was hearing little whispers and voices behind me. And I really got such an eerie feeling. It was so scary in there because I knew I was alone. There was nothing there. I was hearing footsteps. I was hearing whispers. And I think we ended up with probably four or five EVPs from the death tunnel, but the only one that was any good was a very strange one, and I couldn't really make sense of it, but it was the clearest one we got, and it was an EVP that said, it's upside down, man. And I have no idea what that meant. I thought maybe it had something to do with the fact that, you know, that live people would be coming into the facility. You would come in through the death tunnel or the body chute in the winter. And then the dead people were being taken out. I don't know. But that was a crazy experience. And then also when we were at the elevator shaft where there had been a death when the building was abandoned, there was a homeless man who was staying in the building with his dog. And one morning he was found at the bottom of the elevator shaft. Him and his dog were dead, and they don't know if they slipped or were murdered or fell or what happened. But we got an EVP. Do you remember that one, Kathy? You want to tell
that
one?
Oh, I definitely remember that one.
Talk about that one.
It was actually what they call a mimic, and we were talking about it. You know, we were doing EVP, but we were also talking about what had happened, and we said, "I can't believe this happened." I think I said it. I can't believe this happened in the chute.
And
down the shaft. And then it came twice, down the shaft. It was very, very odd. And I couldn't even believe it to the point where I said, I think that's got to be one of us. They finally pulled the video from that particular segment to prove that no one's lips were moving. No one was talking. And we got this great EVP with the two down the shaft. It was almost like they were mocking us because somebody said down the shaft.
I think that we concluded that Kathy was talking about it. I think that she said something like this: "What a horrible way to die." And mm-hmm. I said, "Down the shaft."
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another "down the shaft" right after mine, like kind of in a whisper, "Down the shaft." And mm-hmm. Kathy was like, "No, that's you." And I'm like, "I didn't say it twice." And she goes, "Well, I didn't say it." And Darla didn't say a word through the entire investigation. So the producers actually went back and looked at the footage because they looked at my footage that we had the camera going, and they looked at the production footage. And I swear, I tell you, if anybody watched that show, you know, if you make a mistake, they busted you on it in public. A couple investigators made mistakes on investigations of something they didn't think they said or something that they heard, and they were called out on it. So, you know, they were like, "Well, we're going to check this out." And we were like, "Go ahead, man. We know what happened." So that, to me, I think that was more compelling to us because we were like, what the heck? But, you know, that was just one of several things. And that's just two things that happened on our first visit there.
Right.
We went back, and we had even more incredible experiences.
Yeah, the second time we went there, the one that always stands out is the one that happened in the morgue.
Oh.
We were running. We had on the spirit box, which, you know, the spirit box can be a temperamental beast. You can run that thing for a half hour and have nothing happen. But this night we were running it and really nothing was happening. And we started to ask some questions. And I think Teresa posed the question, or maybe it was Darla that time, who said, "Can you tell us what room we're in?" And the spirit box, clearly a male voice, said "morgue" in a sustained long word that you knew it wasn't, you know, anything else interfering with that spirit box. It was something saying "morgue." I'm telling you, you're in the morgue, people. And it was an amazing opportunity. I mean, just going to that building is an amazing thing. The experiences cannot be beat. The things that happened to us on Paranormal Challenge are just very memorable. We used equipment we never had a chance to ever use before that we probably never can afford even into the future. I mean, that was the first time we used a real melmeter.
And a thermal imaging camera.
Thermal imaging camera, right, all those type of things. So it was hard because they didn't instruct you. They said, "Here it is."
Yeah. And try to use it. Another thing that happened in the morgue, and I think it was like the same session, with the spirit box. And the spirit box, you know, sometimes it's interesting, sometimes it's just gibberish. But besides when it said morgue, we asked, I think one question was, how many spirits are in the room with us? And it came back 7. And then we said, 7? Well, who's 7? And it spit out 7 names.
Yes.
So I thought that was compelling. And then we got the same interaction, I think, up in the surgical suite. I mean, that place was crazy. Now, the one thing I didn't see was the creeper, but we did see some really crazy shadow stuff going on, especially, right. I think it was the third floor or the fourth floor.
It was the fourth floor.
Oh my God! I remember you guys
were going from room to room across the hallway.
I couldn't see it, and they are freaking out over these shadows.
And that was even when the production guy, I mean, one of the production teams saw it too. Because they don't say anything. They hang back and say nothing. But when it was happening, one of them saw it too. And I think they were pretty amazed as well.
Oh, my God.
This doesn't usually happen, is what the guy said.
I think our camera guy, Jimmy, was about to pee his pants. He got so scared.
Yeah. Because there was something unusual happening in that hallway. You could see these shadows just marching back and forth. And it wasn't necessarily the creeper, you know, the guy who goes up the walls and across the ceiling and everything. These were figures moving from room to room, like, I'm going to dart in here before you come. Kind of, that's the feeling I got, is like they're trying to hide. And the surgical wing just was off the hook. It was just something that probably can never be repeated. And we got to meet some cool people then. We got to meet Dave Schrader and Dr. Pamela Heath and I don't remember who else.
Some guy
there.
Named Zach.
Oh, Zach Baggins. I mean, that was it was awesome. And, you know, it was pretty cool. And even the people on his production team are top-notch people who do such a good job with everything. And we got to meet Dark Alley Paranormal, who were our the people we were competing with. So that was very cool. So we've made some friends there that we've sustained through the years. And that's the best thing about being in the paranormal world, is the friendships that you form from all these different things that happen.
Well, that really was an amazing episode, and I had no idea who you guys were or didn't know anything about you until I saw it, and I thought, wow. I was actually covering the show, so I had seen all the episodes, and I think that really was the best episode of that one and only season, and I thought it was very, very compelling. Hey, I'd love to hear about the LEMP, because you went very specifically after we were working on the book. I know the two of you went to investigate that independently and really had some amazing things happen. Before we do that, though, let's make sure we let everyone know how they can get a hold of you guys, the Haunted Housewives.
Well, there's several ways. We have a website, of course, hauntedhousewives.com. Teresa has a Skype. You want to tell them what your Skype is? I don't want to get it wrong. Not your Skype. I'm sorry, Twitter, sorry.
My Twitter, my Twitter is Epic Housewives. At Twitter, and Epic is capital, but Facebook too. We try to stay up on Facebook. It's hard because I'm doing America's Most Haunted, and I'm doing Haunted Housewives, and I'm doing my personal page. But the Twitter and the website, we post all our events, anything we've got coming up, any investigations, and we will be having more opportunities for people to come and investigate with us, and also get involved in some of these fundraisers. So HauntedHousewives.com and Haunted Housewives on Facebook, probably the best ways to get a hold of us.
Yeah, if it's not on Facebook, it's not happening.
That's right.
So the Haunted Housewives public page is a good place to see what's happening with us.
All right, the LEMP, St. Louis. Tell us about it.
Oh, my God. The LEMP Mansion. I am in love with this place. Kathy and I went down for a romantic weekend.
On Valentine's weekend.
Valentine's Day weekend. We went specifically for the book, which was great because I heard about the LEMP, and I remember, Eric, I'm telling you, I'm like, I think this place is great. I think this place is going to be really cool for the book, but I've never been there. So off we went, and what was interesting about the weekend that we went, it just happened to be the anniversary of one of the LEMP's deaths, of Billy LEMP's death. And the LEMP family, they were a family of brewery moguls in St. Louis, and they made their fortune in the beer industry, which many people did back then. But the mansion, this was their old family home where they lived in St. Louis, and it was actually connected by tunnels to their brewery. And the property has an interesting history, and the tunnels underneath the property are an amazing thing on their own, even if there was nothing paranormal going on there. But the family seemed to be touched by tragedy, and there were four LEMP suicides within three generations. And it's very sad to think that these people were so wealthy but yet couldn't find happiness. So we went down to the LEMP Mansion, and boy, did they open their doors for us. They gave us the Lavender Suite, which is the biggest and the nicest of the rooms. There's six suites in the LEMP Mansion. And they set us up in this beautiful room, which is actually two rooms. And we spent the night there, and it was amazing because once the restaurant and the bar shut down, there's nobody there except for the people that are staying there. And of course, there were people staying there that night, but I think after about 11 o'clock, they had other things on their mind because, again, it was Valentine's Day weekend. We did meet a couple people that came looking for ghosts and got so kind of freaked out that they locked themselves in their room. But Kathy had something happen before I even went to bed. She was hearing things and jiggling at the door. And
Definitely there was something trying to get in our door. There, I heard it clearly, and I saw the door handle jiggling. And it wasn't the door that you use to get in and out. It was a door to the other suite where I think they have it so that you're not supposed to use that to go in and out. And that was the door someone was definitely trying to get in. And we even went out in the hall several times to check on things and see what other people were doing, see if other people were, you know, going about. We didn't run in anybody. Like Teresa said, everybody was either locked in their room or whatever. The people across the hallway from us, though, by morning were sleeping out in the hallway on the bench because they got scared of something in their room. Uh-huh. So that was interesting. And they had their doors all open and everything because they said they didn't even want to stay there, but they were afraid. So they laid out in the hallway. It was very odd.
We did have some interesting experiences when we were investigating. And when we were investigating, there was nobody else in there.
No,
I mean,
not
besides
at that time.
Besides the night that we had, that we spent at the LEMP, the next day, all the other guests had left. They had to be out by a certain time in the morning. And we got to stay, and we actually got to come back the second night, too. So we had access to the building when nobody else did. And I remember one of the greatest EVPs we ever got. We were in the front parlor when we were in Billy's office. Was that where
right.
it was?
Yes,
Billy's office. It's all changed now. So since it's a restaurant, it's different than what it was when the Lemps lived there. But we asked, what was the name of the beer that was brewed here? Now, at this time, I had just begun to research the place, so we didn't know that much about it. And we got an EVP that said Falstaff. And we're like, oh, well, we'll have to look that up later, because that's a very strange EVP. It obviously wasn't just something random. It wasn't something that our minds just made out of the noise. It said Falstaff. And when we asked the historian the next day when she came to meet us to give us the historic rundown, she said that was the name of the beer. So that was one amazing EVP. We had some other EVPs happening in the atrium. We had an incredible experience up on the top floor when we were with Betsy Bellinger, and she is the LEMP historian, and she is the one who discovered Zeke. And if anybody knows about the LEMP mansion, you might know the story of Zeke. Zeke supposedly is their house spirit. He is, according to legend, the spirit of a little boy. He was one of the LEMP family members. He was either the youngest of Joseph Lemp's sons, or he was, somebody said, I had actually heard in my research that he was Billy Lemp's illegitimate son, but he was not. He was supposedly Billy's brother. So this was something that I believed to be true when we went down to the Lemp Mansion. I had heard it on all the TV shows that the Lemp has been featured on, and it was on Ghost Hunters, it was on Ghost Lab, it's been on, you know, My Ghost Story, all the different paranormal shows. So we had heard about this Zeke. Well, we found out that Zeke, basically the story of Zeke originated from Betsy, from this psychic. She said, no, I'm a psychic and I've seen him. And so the entire story, the entire legend of Zeke came from the mouth and the mind of a psychic. Now, I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just saying that's where it originated. And she said that he was some sort of disfigured. He had some sort of deformity on his face. And because of that, the Lemps hid him away in the attic. Not that he was mistreated, but he was kind of hidden from public view because that was not a polite society. You hid away these things that you were ashamed of. And that he was the monkey-faced boy, as he was cruelly called by visitors and gawkers who would occasionally see him. So this is the legend of Zeke that we had heard about. The Booth brothers did a documentary at the Lemp Mansion talking all about this unfortunate child who had this disfigurement. And so we were, you know, thrilled to find out about Zeke. We wanted to hear all about it. People have been coming there for years. They have captured EVPs. The Booth brothers caught this crazy figure on their imager which looks like somebody with a bag on their head. So there's all this supposed evidence or documentation of this Zeke, but there is absolutely no historical basis for him. We could find nothing. And Eric, you know this too from our research, besides what Kathy and I found from talking to Betsy, there was nothing. So was he there? Did Zeke happen? Was he really born? Was he just a figment of our imagination? Well, if so, if he was never a child that lived, where's the EVPs coming from? What are people seeing? The whole thing is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, it really could be one of these cases where, is it a chicken, you know, or egg? Was there an actual human being? Well, it appears not, because there's just absolutely no record. And a family like the Lemps, you know, if this was some unknown backwoods family, you wouldn't necessarily expect documentation. But the Lemps have been very, very well documented and very well covered by, you know, the 19th century and early 20th century version of paparazzi. In fact, when I was doing the research on the place, I found a number of very, very detailed stories about them, and in particular the divorce case of Billy in the New York Times. I mean, that's how well covered it was, and that's how important the Lemp family was. They were being covered as, you know, national figures in the New York Times. So, I mean, my guess is that there was not a historical figure. But like you said, that doesn't mean there is not some sort of paranormal entity who meets that description, answers to that name. So it is. It's a very interesting case. Was this something generated by the will of ghost hunters? Was this something that sprung complete from the mind of a psychic? I mean, there's all kinds of possible answers, and it really does raise a lot of fascinating questions. That's the kind of thing that happened, things like that, several times in the book when in doing the research, where we found what seemed to be pretty clear evidence of paranormal activity and sort of repeatable paranormal activity, but we weren't really able to find any particular real life documentation. So does that mean that it's a figment of everyone's imagination? No, not necessarily. I think that the world is a very mysterious place. All right, well, we haven't even mentioned the two really super obvious places that certainly in the case of Willoughby Cole, I mean, you are literally the paranormal entities. you're the boss, and you have discovered it and in fact developed it, and not to quite the same extent, but almost so, it seems, for the Knickerbocker. So we only have about 8 more minutes, but I'd love to hear a real quick rundown just on the highlights of the Willoughby Cole or the Knickerbocker or both, though it will be difficult in 8 minutes.
True that.
Let's just do Willoughby Cole. Knickerbocker is great, but Willoughby Cole is close to our heart. So go, you tell him, Kathy.
Oh, you, okay.
It's your baby.
Willoughby Cole obviously is in Willoughby. It's on Erie Street. It's one of the featured sites on the Willoughby Ghost Walk. For years, I have been in love with the building. I have some sort of a connection with the building, I feel. And I used to just sit up there in the parking lot and stare at it sometimes. Well, through the years, I've gotten to know the owners fairly well, and I've been privy to ask them, you know, are there spirits? The current owner, Jay, is a very skeptical man, and he's never really been one to tell ghost stories, but he has been very gracious in allowing me and Teresa to go in and do our own investigations to see what haunts Willoughby Cole. We have never been disappointed. I can't even tell you, when I think back to how many times we've been there through the years, I can't think of a time that we were disappointed and said, let's pack it up and go home because nothing's going on. We've had everything happen from being touched, hearing disembodied voices, disembodied sounds, poltergeist activity, Just the list goes on and on. Just recently, a door shut 2 times in the same night of its own volition. We caught a picture of an entity on the stairs that, you know, as skeptical as I myself am of paranormal photographs, this one just has me, you know, it is a mystery, as you said, Eric. It's a very mysterious thing. What is that thing standing on the steps? How did it get there, and why is it in the picture? So there's been these type of things happening at Willoughby Cole through the years consistently, to the point where I can't deny that something of, you know, something otherworldly is happening there. Why the spirits are continuing to haunt that building, I can't tell you. Are they the spirits of people who are deceased who have had a relationship with the building? Perhaps. Are there other spirits that are gathering there because of the amount of activity? You can't say. But all I know is there's something happening there, and Teresa and I probably will never give up on that particular property.
No, absolutely not. And the picture that Kathy's referring to was actually a photograph that was taken by one of the guests on the ghost walk. We posted this thing everywhere. It was on America's Most Haunted. It was on the Haunted Housewives page. We put it everywhere because it is still so astounding to me that one of the guests captured this picture. And actually, if I wasn't there that night, I probably wouldn't have believed it. We were telling the story about Mr. Norris, and he was one of the previous owners who had died tragically on the property. He had supposedly fallen from an open third floor window. Well, we believe now that there was a very good possibility that he was helped out that window and didn't go willingly or by accident. But the story was that it was an accident. Well, we think that Mr. Norris haunts the building. We think he's one of the spirits there. And we often talk to him. We've even asked, "What happened, Mr. Norris, what happened to you?" And we get the EVP back, murdered. So I don't know. It sounds like something happened.
Mm-hmm.
But on this particular night, one of my guests on the ghost walk said, went up to the window. We were outside Willoughby Cole, and he had his camera, and he said, "Mr. Norris, it's time for your selfie." This kid was a teenager. And I'm like, oh, great, you know. But whatever, he was having a good time, and he took the picture, and then he let out this little yelp, and he showed me, and there was a face. And when you zoomed in, I mean, I don't know how else to describe it. It looks like a face. It looks kind of like a disfigured human face. So I was kind of shocked, and he kept taking pictures. Everybody was taking pictures. Well, the same kid took another picture, this time at a different angle. And he caught the same face, but it was in a different part of the building, and it was kind of facing a different direction. It was the same face at a slightly different angle, and that was incredible. And boy, Kathy and I tried forever to recreate this, to debunk it, to find some sort of explanation, and we could not. And that just happened just this last fall.
Yeah, and just weeks ago.
Just this is the kind of thing that happens all the time. Again, it's almost like we can count on things to happen, and you know, as protective as we are of Willoughby Cole, we want to tell the world about it, yet we're keeping it kind of close to our hearts because we don't want it to be overrun by people who don't appreciate it, because it is a business. It is not a paranormal place. These people don't make any money off their ghosts. But we, you know, to share the paranormal activity that happens in Willoughby Cole on such a regular basis, I mean, that it would have had a higher place in our book. We put it at number 10 only because nobody knows about it. So we couldn't put it up higher because nobody knows about it except for the few people in our region. But I tell you, there's as many spirits there as there is at any other place that we put in our book.
Well, and because of the book, I will tell you people are knowing about it, because I was contacted by a paranormal team from Wisconsin that would like to come and investigate at Willoughby Cole this summer.
Wow. Yeah, we're getting a lot of requests. Unfortunately, it is not ready for public investigations at this point. So.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to add about that, because of course Willoughby Cole is where we had our gala book launch event, and you know, we always say one of the kind of rules of paranormal investigators is you really can't expect the spirits to perform on demand. You know, it's a little demeaning to to demand their participation because you're there. Well, I'm here now, so it's time for you to do something, entertain me. But here we did. We did just purely what we thought would be basically just a little demonstration media tour right before the book launch event at Willoughby Cole. And we actually had things happen. You guys led an EVP session there on the loading dock and had things happen as if on demand.
Right. We knew it would happen too.
Yeah. I mean, I like the look of astonishment on the one reporter's face when that happened.
Oh, yeah. You wrote up a nice story about it too. That was in Scene, wasn't it?
That was fun. I mean, the thing is you can never be 100% sure, but I tell you, if there's ever a place I would bet money that something's going to happen, it's there. So
I agree.
All right, well, ladies, we could go on, and in fact we have, and in fact we will. But it was really fun to be able to talk to you guys as interviewees to kind of flip it around, because it's something we haven't really done before. A lot of this information comes out and leaks out, and we tell our stories when we're interviewing other people. But it was really nice to be able to talk to you, and in particular you, Kathy, who we haven't had on probably as much as we should. And
thanks, Sarah.
It was really fun to talk to you as the world-famous Haunted Housewives. And you guys are really moving up in the world, moving up in the paranormal world. And I don't even know if Teresa has said anything to you yet, Kathy, but we've kind of been invited, and we certainly include you, because this includes the Haunted Housewives, to participate in a video about the Ohio State Reformatory. And I think that is something that will really be fun, and it'll be a way to kind of pull together America's Most Haunted and the Haunted Housewives and, of course, the team that we'll also be working with, and we'll talk about that later. But I really see things moving forward kind of on all fronts. And, you know, the way these things go is kind of one aspect moves forward, then that kind of stays in one place. Another aspect then moves forward, but it all keeps moving forward. And I'm really glad to see that you guys in particular, you as